I was surprised when the Central Conference of American Rabbis made the issue, the authority of the rabbi, central to its 1980 conference. The theme seems unusually enigmatic and paradoxical for a body like the CCAR, which has made a great deal of the Tame, T-A-A-M-E-I, Ha, H-A hyphen mitzvot, M-I-T-Z-V-O-T, but not insisted on the duty of, on our duty to observe the specific mitzvot, M-I-T-Z-V-O-T, themselves. Liberal Judaism began when our founders broke the old O-L HaMitzvot, H-A hyphen M-I-T-Z-V-O-T. They denied the absolute authority of the halachic, H-A-L-A-C-H-I-C structure. In so doing, denied themselves, comma, as rabbis, comma, the authorized place as administrators of the halacha, which had been the traditional role of the rabbinate. Does a professional body of rabbis have authority if it denies the structure which alone can provide it? The spirit of Judaism, comma, insofar as it can be defined, comma, is a compelling vision. And to be promoters of that vision is a dignified calling, but it is not one where authority is readily achieved. Certainly not authority in the sense of malchut, M-A-L-C-H-U-T, or memshalah, M-E-M-S-H-A-L-A-H. That authority which the dictionary defines as the power to determine, comma, adjudicate, comma, or settle issues or disputes, colon, a power or right delegated or given, colon, a person in whom power is vested, period. New paragraph. Absence of authority is not a condition which the modern rabbinate has willingly accepted. I've always been struck by the fact that we insist on defining our vision of a just society as a law of righteousness, which assumes that the rabbi can have an authorized place in administrating that law. The law of righteousness is in fact nothing more than a vague messianic hope. Law needs to be specific. Law needs to have empowering agencies and coercive power. The law of righteousness does not. When we renounce the authority of Sinai, we put distance between ourselves and all those who before had borne the title rabbi. We declared that compulsion is not our métier. That quotation, come let us reason together, end of quotation, is the method we chose to adopt. New paragraph. We chose to define our modulation of Judaism as prophetic. Amos is a noble figure, and his teachings have been have had impact through the generations. But Amos had no authority. Amaziah, A-M-A-Z-I-A-H, did. We have no authority. The rabbis who remain under the halacha, H-A-L-A-C-H-A, did. They had the authority to pronounce Nidui, N-I-D-D-U-I, and Cherem, H-E-R-E-M, to censor books, to authorize a marriage, the dissolution of a marriage, and even at various times to be part of a court which had the authority to impose fines and even capital punishment. Old terms have a way of carrying with them a number of symbolic connotations. We are, when we are ordained at the Hebrew Union College, the act is called Smicha, S-E-M-I-C-H-A. Smicha in Talmudic times was a an authorization of a scholar by previously ordained scholars, which testified to his competence and freed him from the danger of being fined if other authorities questioned his judgments. Our semicha was nothing more than the, though it had the same, though it was written with the same terms, Yoreh, Y-O-R-E-H, Yoreh, Y-O-R-E-H, comma, Yadin, Y-A-D-I-N, comma, Yadin, Y-A-D-I-N, gave us no other authority but to go out and to seek a job with the congregation to do those things which we and the congregation mutually agreed upon. If in fact we look upon our role as administrative authorities under the law of righteousness, we would be asking for the right to be a watch and ward society in our communities. Rabbi sometimes had this role. I read recently a fascinating history of the Jews of Aleppo, A-L-E-P-P-O, by a descendant of that community. It seems that a number of the rabbis spent their time on Erev Yariv Shabbat, S-H-A-B-B-A-T, wandering the streets of the town, making sure that shopkeepers had closed their shops early enough to get home, and that even the shoeshine boys were rooted out of their stalls so that the Sabbath could be fully observed. The world that we operate in, the synagogue and the Jewish community, certainly is not strong enough to enforce the law of righteousness on the larger society. I'm sure that given the experience of on both sides of the Iron Curtain, none of us would want to use that kind of efficient and ruthless power, which alone can force people to follow your way and to agree with your thoughts. We would not want to be Mao, M-A-O, say T-S-E-Tsung, T-S-U-N-G, who can destroy millions to create a cultural revolution to resolve the inner contradictions of China's social order. Paragraph, the authority of the rabbis of an early generation was circumscribed. All authority is, runs to the purse. And throughout history, all systems of legitimate authority have been twisted so that the administrators are forced to limit their attention to those areas which the elite are prepared to allow them. Much is made of the fact that we enjoy freedom of the pulpit and that our predecessors often had to check their lectures with the Parnassim, P-A-R-N-A-S-S-I-M. But let us recognize that when the medieval rabbis spoke, they defined the practice of the community, both in ritual and moral terms. We enjoy the freedom of the pulpit precisely because our congregants need not attend our sermons and can easily dismiss them or dissent from them. And nor should we begrudge them that right. Who among the members of the conference works through his position on a social or ethical issue, but revises his position when he discovers that a resolution of the conference takes a somewhat different tack on that particular area. On the appropriate Sabbath, we may praise our Father's faith for having said, Nase, N-A-A-S-E-H, V, apostrophe, N-I-S-H-M-A-H. Our conference has authority over us in union matters, but not when it operates in any of the more substantive areas. It is a trade union, in effect, rather than a synod, S-Y-N-O-D. We have made our bed, and for what many considered good reason, but we should now not be innocent or naive about the consequences of our acts. Those who fear an absence of authority or who are unsatisfied to lead lives where in which people will always be pulling away from good advice and counsel really would do better using their Jewish learning in areas other than the congregational rabbinate. Paragraph. I'm not saying that rabbinic authority was necessarily a desirable thing or, in fact, that great dignity attached to it. Most of us have read I.B. Singer's book, In My Father's Court. Singer's rabbi father's court was not a magnificent audience chamber filled with ambassadors from faraway places and grave discussions, but the crowded living room, bedroom of a tenement apartment in Warsaw, and its days were spent working through the problems of the impoverished lives of the people who shared the tenement with him. Yet he had authority. He could dissolve a marriage or force a housewife to throw out a chicken that she had bought in the marketplace. We would not want such authority, but that is another matter. For Rabbinic Judaism, like the structure of the medieval of the Roman Catholic Church or of Islam, wove out an all-embracing religious law based on the thesis that God had revealed the way. In our case, to Moses on Mount Sinai. Authority came from above. Man's role was to prepare himself and become knowledgeable enough in the given in order to administer it effectively. Rabbinic Judaism was based on the legitimacy of authority. Quote, judges and legal officials you shall appoint for you in all of your gates. When in medieval times our thinkers began to philosophize about political theory, they minced no words about the importance of a central authority. For man cannot long tolerate endless division. Well, in this instance is a paragraph from the Sefer S-E-F-E-R Ha-H-A hyphen H-I-N-U-C-H of Aaron A-A-R-O-N Ha-H-A Levi L-E-V-I, brackets 13th century, chapter 71. This is the quote indented. No settlement can be established unless an individual is made head whose power and authority will be obeyed. This is made necessary because man's opinions vary. No group can ever agree on a single program. Lacking some sovereign authority, men will frustrate their every purpose. In order that they may succeed and be effective, a society must accept the opinions of one man, whether it is good or bad. Three dots. Authority is better than division of opinion, for the latter makes frustration and futility inevitable. Modern life, the paragraph begins, when men insisted on the right to advise and consent to divine authority. The Protestant Reformation accepted the idea of a divinely revealed law or truth, but insisted that each individual, comma, rather than any ecclesiastical authority, comma, must interpret the scriptures according to their lights. Soon men went farther and insisted that all rights were vested in the individual. John Locke spoke of inalienable rights and of a social contract. That is to say, that men, for various reasons, might willingly give over a part of their authority to a state in order to promote the common weal and permit public safety. But but there was no divine right of kings. There was no infallibility associated with ecclesiastical power. Men and women had to make their own decisions, and would give to the state only those limited powers which were necessary for social life to function. Quote, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union," three dots, end of quote. The state has no inalienable right to authority. And since those who have authority inevitably want to aggrandize it, the philosophers of the Enlightenment began to explore a variety of institutional limitations, like judicial review and due process, initiative and referendum, which would allow the people to keep control over the power ambitions of those who occupy office. Note the two elements. Power now rests with the individual, and there's an acknowledgement that there needs to be certain rules for society to operate. New paragraph. Liberal Judaism began not when some of the burghers of Hamburg and Berlin spoke of bringing an organ into the temple or confirmation or girls into religious education, but when 50 years before Moses Mendelssohn had challenged the ecclesiastical authority of the rabbis by insisting that the church and the synagogue should have no judicial power. He specifically attacked the rights of Cherem, H-E-R-E-M, and Nidui, N-I-D-D-U-I. He acknowledged that the state, for reasons of public safety, could enforce rules, but in matters of faith, there was to be no coercion. In fact, he was doing was to transform Judaism into a pietism, that is, into a practice which was defined within ritual terms, but not within activist terms. A religion of the synagogue and of the home, but not of the street. Paragraph. This approach could not be sustained, not only because once the whole concept of revelation is challenged, the idea of a revealed revelation becomes an anachronism, but because the redefinition in the 19th century of Judaism as prophetic suggested that the impact of the tradition must be in the street as well as in the synagogue. Pietism is simply not the Jewish way. There is nothing in the Torah tradition which makes for a rigid and complete separation between the secular and the spiritual. Judaism, new paragraph, Jews sought to accommodate their tradition to the new perception of power emanating from the people. But they were unsuccessful and remain unsuccessful is in devising a social compact which would allow some necessary authority to emerge among us. Isaac Mayer Wise apparently was working in this direction when he convened all in 1855 all of the congregations of the United States in Cleveland in an attempt to create a synod. And in doing so, he spoke encouragingly of using the rabbinic law as a basis for congregational practice. But individualism was in the air, and the individual congregations refused to accept any external authority. And what was true of the congregations was true of their membership. Privatism has been the order of the day. Nobody is going to force me to or coerce me to agree with them. No one likes coercion. But I wonder if we're satisfied with the taped response which the Task Force on Jewish Identity received at a number of times as it interviewed members of our congregations. What do you find appealing about Reform Judaism? Answer, that allows me to make up my own mind. Can a movement, in fact, exist where each individual is simply making up his or her own mind? The paragraph. Now, for a while, the challenge of privatism, hyphen, I'm going to do my thing, hyphen, was not apparent to all. There were the sense of being Jewish was a strong one. The social separation of Jews from non-Jews in the United States was still a palpable fact. When it began to disintegrate, the traumas of the Holocausts and of the creation of the State of Israel brought a new sense of community. A closely knit family which lives in its own home can allow us members to think their own thoughts and go their own way, except for anniversaries and birthdays and perhaps a Sabbath meal. What happens when the external pressures, when there is not a single home, and the external pressures are diminished to the point of being non-existent? Then the full consequence of this individualism becomes apparent, and to a certain degree it has clearly become apparent among us. We do not have institutions, we have agglomerations. The Union of American Hebrew Congregations is an agglomeration of congregations which happen to pay dues to the Union. The Central Conference of American Rabbis is an agglomeration of professionals who happen to have been, who have studied at the Hebrew Union College. The members of our congregations are accumulations of individuals who happen to live in a particular community and to decide it for a whole variety of reasons, comma, some noble and some not, comma, to affiliate with us. Union. The Union investigates carefully the financial structures of our congregations to make sure that the 12% dues are paid. It does not examine the content of the religious school curriculum or the nature of worship. If a congregation worships man and or light, that by itself would not be reason for exclusion. The conference passes resolutions but makes no attempt to police them. Twice we have torn ourselves apart over the issue of rabbinic participation into marriage, and despite the very practical consequences of confusion of roles in the community, no one has been disciplined in any way for flaunting or violating the conference's decisions. Would we remove anyone from our membership in the congregation because they also pay dues to a spouse's church, or because they voted for Ronald Reagan after an impassioned sermon on our parts? Now, there are among us, this new paragraph, comma, particularly in the Cincinnati campus, Cincinnati school, comma, teachers who insist on the virtue of individualism, freedom, and autonomy. These are glorious words, and they have great appeal. But given the sociological reality of our communities, like all ideas, if they are taken to an extreme, their virtue is transformed into a vice. What other professional body would allow one rabbi to cater to the demands of his community, the demands of some Jews for a rabbi at an intermarriage, despite the cost to those rabbis who are trying to hold on to the will of the conference and the historic role of the rabbi as a Masader, M-E-S-A-D-D-E-R, Kiddushin, K-I-D-D-U-S-H-I-N. If reform is in fact nothing more than telling everyone to make up their own minds, by what right have rabbis to refuse their services when a young person comes to them and says, I want to be a fulfilled Jew, and I also want to belong to the synagogue? Paragraph. At the conference, there were those who suggested that we had essentially a definition by a negative consensus. There are certain things that we will not do. We would not tolerate in the Union a synagogue which might transform the God of our fathers, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, into the an ecumenical God, God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Jesus, and Moses, or where Christological themes were added to the Judaic ones. I'm not so sure. There's always been a tendency among us to emphasize the value of Jesus as a prophet and to the ties that bind rather than the distinctions which separate. Kerut, H-E-F-K-E-R-U-T, is, I would submit at this point in time, a real danger. Is I've come to feel that the only principle on which the conference, the union in our congregations agrees, is that of freedom of conscience. But conscience is a culturally conditioned phenomenon, and certainly no movement worthy of its name can fail to have standards. Somehow we must move towards the development of a social contract. How we have to learn to say there are things that we will not do, even if we are tempted to do them. It's interesting that the ethics committee of the conference deals largely with cases involving placement. It makes no attempt to deal with questions of moral turpitude and moral and sexual turpitude. Ready explanation is, quote, Israel, even if an Israelite sins, he remains an Israelite, comma, but is that really the standard that a professional body can adopt? Paragraph. When we tried to draw together the themes on which we agreed for our tercentenary, a group of theologians found that they could not, and so that ultimate triumph of the equivocal, E-Q-U-I-V-O-C-A-L, the centenary perspective. The Pittsburgh platform and the Columbus platform had been hotly debated, and minorities had voted against their various planks. They are both only words, and no coercive power was associated. But at least the movement had shape, and the movement, the congregation, could be defined. 40 years ago, it was possible to go to liberal congregations anywhere in the United States and find essentially the same kind of worship service. Today, individuality and eccentricity are so rampant that our people, when they visit other congregations, often feel you know, aliens in a strange land. In an age of future shock, I wonder if it's not time for us to find the limits of what we euphemistically call creativity, and to begin to think of standards and standardization, of the needs of a movement, of a community. I know that there have always been differences in Israel, and I'm not pleading for the return of excommunication or for a catechism. I'm suggesting that on a symbolic level, we must again find ways to present a common and understandable front to the communities. I'm afraid that the community reads us largely as well-intentioned individuals who tend to be more liberal than most, and whose liberalism can be dismissed because we've never met a payroll. I'd accept the traditional vision of the Torah, and we cannot, Certainly we can begin to spin out a Torah of our own. It's not simply a matter of forms. It's a matter of standards. What standards are involved in preaching simply the freedom of conscience? Standards involved are when we try and force people to live with a lack of caution, as if the Messianic age were really here. New paragraph. I would like to see the conference explore the whole area of social contracts. Given the inability to define authority in the sense of power, Jerry Molino, in his presidential address to the conference in 1980, and Harold Saperstein, his major paper in the Theory of the Rabbi, moved beyond questions of power to another cluster of definitions, which have to do with samchut, S-A-M-C-H-U-T, or a citation as from a book, semicolon, a specialist in a given field, who is a source of conclusive statements or testimony, semicolon, one who is cited or appealed to as an expert. There is personal satisfaction in having explored the intricacies of our tradition and becoming competent in a number of areas. And certainly there is some kind, there is a correlation of some kind between our competence and wisdom as knowledgeable Jews and our relationship with the congregations. But this must not be overemphasized. There's no member of the conference who does not know of scholars who were rudely treated by boards. The power of the purse always prevails. I wonder if any of us were a combination of Wolfson, Baron, and Heschel, whether we would have greater authority in our congregations and communities than someone who was young, bright, and willing to do whatever it was that the individuals of power wanted him to do. Fortunately, many in the congregations respect learning. But let us beware of what Harold Saperstein's called the idea of becoming experts in Judaism, end of quote. There are no such beasts. Judaism is a wide-ranging religious civilization, and that most any of us can know with any degree of competence some small corners within it. I remember a discussion of the Academic Advisory Council of the National Foundation of Jewish Culture on that whole question of how anyone becomes competent to teach a survey course in Judaism to undergraduates. Most colleges have abandoned the survey of Western civilization type of course, precisely because it's impossible to deal competently with any area. All that really is being done is a repetition of a number of secondary sources. New paragraph. In 1846, Heinrich Gretz, G-R-E-T-Z, published a programmatic essay entitled "The Interpretation of History." In it, he analyzed three attempts by contemporaries to present the essence of Judaism. Samson Raphael Hirsch, H-A-R-S-C-H, Samuel Hirsch, H-A-R-S-C-H, and Zacharias Frankel, F-R-A-N-K-E-L. And he showed how each had used great scholarship in order to find in Judaism that approach which was congruent with his own understanding. That what often is talked about when we speak of experts in Judaism, somebody who simply has a few basic ideas of what Judaism must be, and then uses these as the judge of each and every activity. Obviously, we ought to become as confident within Jewish civilization as we possibly can. And obviously the quality of our lives will have some impact on the quality of our relationships with our congregations, but not completely. There is still the question of the authority, and there's still the reality of frustration. It's hard to live in a world where it's not clear exactly what we must do.